Morning, everybody. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thank you. All right, we have a quorum and it is 10 o'clock. So I am going to start the meeting. All right, welcome to the May 14th Pension Committee meeting. The first item on the agenda is approval of the February 12th, 2026 minutes. Does anybody have any questions or comments about those minutes? Hearing none, they'll stand approved. Next item is public comment. Ms. Albright, is there anybody online to make a public comment?
Anybody on the line would like to make a public comment, please dial 5-star.
You're unmuted, Ms. Albright, but I couldn't hear you. Is there anybody online?
There's no one to make a comment.
All right, thank you. Okay, the next item is the performance reports of the pension and OPEB funds. And again, we have Mr. Pat Wing from Arquette Associates. And I'm going to turn it over
anyone to anyone on the line who would like to make a public comment.
Good morning, everyone. You hear me okay?
Please dial 5-star.
All right. Bear with me for a quick second, please, as I share my screen here. Everybody see that okay? Okay, great. So with all that said, again, good morning, everyone. We're gonna talk a little bit about the Q1 results now for the pension and the OPEB, but as I'm sure many, if not all of you know, the data I'm about to share here are, I don't wanna say irrelevant, but not nearly as timely given what's happened in markets over the past 5 or 6 weeks. It's been a wildly different environment than that of which we saw in Q1. So as usual, I'll try to weave in some commentary around what's been happening more recently from an economic and market perspective. And then we'll share the April performance update as well. And again, very different numbers in April than we saw in Q1. But with all that said, yeah, we'll just start at a high level from an economic perspective and then get into markets. But we did see the economy accelerate in Q1, as I'm highlighting here. Real GDP came in at an annualized rate of about 2%. That was modestly below economists' expectations, but a notable rebound from Q4. And you can see in these two fully colored in bars here. Now, as you may remember, both Q4 and Q1 highly distorted by the government shutdown, which comprised about half of Q4. So we had a big decline in government spending in Q4, which weighed on the GDP data. And in Q1, a rebound in that measure. So that was certainly helpful from an economic perspective, and the continued AI infrastructure build out definitely contributing positively to growth. And we've talked about that at length over the past couple of quarters. Now, as it relates to the economy itself, obviously the big story out there right now is the Iranian conflict and what's going on in the Strait of Hormuz. Now, as we continue over the next couple of months, the economic data themselves may look and feel a little bit different than what we've seen so far in Q1 and really in April. We've seen some impact from obviously an inflation perspective in the March numbers and the April numbers, but as far as what's going on out that way, it hasn't gotten better. And what I mean by that is basically the oil flow through the Strait. And we talk a little bit about this in the middle bullet point, namely that right now we have a flow problem. So if we look at the chart below, this is showing the normal oil flows through the Strait, about 20 million barrels per day. What's getting through right now, and this is a little bit dated, but a month and a half, but again, things haven't gotten much better incrementally since then, is only a little bit more than 1 million barrels. Now, there have been other responses, as you see in these other bars, via pipeline redirections, inventory drawdowns, strategic petroleum releases, et cetera, but this is effectively the net hit to reserves each day based on what's going on. And a lot of the impact so far has been mitigated to some degree by all these drawdowns of inventories and releasing of reserves, but we'll get to a point where we can no longer do that, right? A lot of the storage facilities have what's called operational floors, meaning that you can't effectively draw them down to zero. There has to be some oil and other stocks in those facilities in order for them to continue to run. and maintain the storage. And the best estimate that we've seen is if this doesn't improve by the end of June or early July, then it could prove problematic. Effectively, we'll move from a supply response that can no longer be there, given all these drawdowns, to effectively demand destruction, right? If the oil's not flowing to where it gets to or where it needs to be. And that would be more problematic for places like Europe and certain places in Asia that are net energy importers, not as much for the US since we're a net energy exporter. But all that said, we still have to tolerate the price of oil, which is a global benchmark. So when we think about those dynamics, if we continue on this progression, then, you know, the June, July timeframe, again, could prove somewhat problematic given oil is not getting to where it needs to be. Now, that said, when we think about that dynamic, that's been well covered by the media and in the headlines, but there are other critical industrial and agricultural commodities that typically transit the strait. You know, if we think about some industrial commodities, of, you know, a decent amount of the world's copper supply usually flows through the strait, a decent amount of the world's helium flows through the strait, and that's a critical input to semiconductor chip manufacturing, and about one third of the world's fertilizers transit through the strait. So if we take a look at the top right chart, we're showing the price of one of those, urea, in gray here, and the year-over-year change over the past some odd years. And overlaid in green is food price inflation here in the U.S. And we can see directionally, it's a pretty strong relationship, which makes sense. But what we're showing this to the right here is we're pushing forward the urea price by about 9 months, because obviously it would take time for fertilizer inputs, increasing price to generally flow down to what's on the shelves and wholesalers and retailers from a food price perspective. So long-winded way of saying, even if we get the energy issue under control, we have these other sort of supply constraints right now that could affect inflation later this year. And this dynamic is certainly providing a challenging backdrop for Federal Reserve policy. So we have a new chairman now. He was approved by the Senate, I believe, earlier this week in his first meeting. Will be coming up in not too much time here, but the dynamics from the conflict and an inflation outlook perspective has changed dramatically what the market is expecting from the Fed. So when we sat here in February and had the meeting, market was pricing in maybe 2 rate cuts this year, another one next year, and now effectively pricing in no rate cuts this year, maybe one next year. So that's had an impact of the market pricing out rate cuts. It's pushed up interest rates, particularly on the short end of the yield curve. And with rates increasing in Q1, that meant a challenged outlook for bond prices. And so, to some degree, certainly playing a role in the equity drawdown we saw, particularly in the U.S. in Q1. So with that as some context, why don't we shift gears and talk a little bit about markets now. And Q1, which are the green bars here to the right, it echoed Q1 of last year to some degree. And what I mean by that is a year ago, U.S. equities were the worst performing major asset class, as they were in Q1 of this year. And pretty much everything else outperformed U.S. equities at the margin. Now, last year, most other asset classes were actually marginally positive. Here in Q1 of this year, most were actually marginally negative. But if we take a look at where the funds have exposure to, start with equities. Again, U.S. equities down about 4%, given a decent rally in the last couple of trading days of the quarter. You know, not too much of a drawdown. At the peak drawdown, we were off maybe 9-10% or so. So a decent recovery in the quarter end. But they were outperformed by developed non-U.S. and emerging market equities, the latter of which, you know, quote unquote, led the way, even though it was marginally down for the quarter. As far as bonds are concerned, you see right here, basically flat. So yields going up, putting downward pressure on bond prices, effectively negating the quarterly income accrued and received by fixed income holders. Bank loans here, you can see down around 0.5%, not terribly surprising given what equity markets did, that they were marginally negative and behind investment grade bonds. But then as far as the other asset classes within the pension and the OPEB, when we look at things like real estate here, surely we'll see it was up more than 1%. Not a huge impact given it's an incredibly small weighting in both funds now, but infrastructure was up a little bit more than 2.5%, so providing some ballast for both funds in an environment where pretty much all traditional assets like equities and fixed income was either flat or down, as in the case of the U.S. Now, when we take a look under the hood in U.S. equity markets, and this will be helpful context for when we look at some of the returns of the underlying investments, what we see is two very divergent pictures depending on where you are within the market. So what I mean by that, if we look at things from a sector perspective, and those returns in the top right, and the lighter bars are the Q1 numbers, this covers mid and large cap stocks. So if we ignore energy for a second, which was up more than 40% on the back of the huge jump in oil prices, we do see a theme in here, namely that more defensive areas, like a consumer staple, so that was up about 8%, like REITs and utilities that were up about 4 and 8% respectively, outperformed, whereas many of the sectors that did poorly, namely communication services, consumer discretionary, and information technology, what do we know about those sectors? That's where those mega cap growth stocks are housed. So this pattern that we've talked about over the past handful of years continues, namely that kind of the mega cap growth oriented related names usually underperform in market weakness, but in turn have led things to the upside, as we've seen more recently over the past 6 weeks or so. Now, that said, it was a very different environment in small cap stocks. Here's proxied by the Russell 2000, specifically how a defensive subset of this index did relative to the broad Russell 2000 benchmark. So the defensive subset, it's defined down here below, but pretty much consists of, you know, more stable companies, companies that are largely more immune to what's going on in the economy or market volatility. And this is the relative performance. So if the line is increasing, it means the more defensive cohort is outperforming and vice versa. And despite a decent start to the quarter, what we saw is a plateau, maybe mid-ish, late-ish January, and then a flip in the other direction where those stocks ended well below the broad market. So again, if we think about it as an accounting identity, what we know is that if the defensive subset underperformed the broad market, then by definition, the more cyclical speculative pockets within small caps outperformed in Q1. So it was a little bit different thematically within smaller companies relative to more mid-size and larger companies where defensives outperformed up here. But in the small cap space, it was more cyclical speculative pockets of that market that did well. Now, with all that said, hopefully some helpful context for when we get into the results here. I'll start with the pension as always, and then quickly cover the OPEB. And then when we get to the update, I'll make some comments around what's been happening more recently and some of our outlook here moving forward through the rest of 26. And I'll cite all this data here as we work through the numbers. But if we look at 23, we see the pension began the year at about $194.25 million, a little bit more, at a modest cash inflow, but that was more than offset by the net investment change of negative about $2.27 million, given what happened in capital markets. So this negative investment change translated into a return of negative 1.2%. That was about a half a percentage point ahead of that policy index benchmark. So from a fiscal year perspective through March, and again, very different picture as we sit here this morning, we were still up about 5.8%, maybe about a percentage point shy of the actuarial assumed rate of return. We're well north of that this morning, and I'll give you a better picture here in just a few short minutes. But as far as it relates to Q1, as I noted earlier in the market environment, with a lot of, at least in the mid and large cap space, you know, generally those geared to AI, mega cap growth, et cetera, underperforming, as we'll see here shortly, the equity bucket within both the pension and OPEB did quite well in that environment, at least on a relative basis. Now, as far as some of the activity during the quarter, as I scroll down a bit, I did want to highlight this. We talked about this at the meeting in February, and at that time, I had noted we were likely to trim some from the equity bucket and refunnel that back down into fixed income. But as far as the fixed income itself, most of the rebalancing would be weighted towards the shorter end of the year yield curve. In other words, if we move the money into fixed income, it was going to be in an area that was much less interest rate sensitive than the overall fixed income market. So to illustrate that, you can see here towards the middle latter half of February here, we did draw about $1.5 million out of international stocks and those funds flow directly down. You can see here 500 grand of that into treasuries intermediate term, but then a million into short duration. So about two-thirds, one-third, but two-thirds to shorter duration, really on the 1 to 3 year part of the curve. And some of those assets, just about a third in the more intermediate 2 to 10 part of the curve. So we did execute that rebalancing and funnel back into fixed income, but within the fixed income market, much less interest rate sensitive than the overall market. With that said, if we take a quick look at page 27, as always, just a quick snapshot of how the fund's doing relative to other public defined benefit plans you see here that use this third party platform that we do. And again, the chart here is just a different representation of the data on this on these two tables, but I think it's easiest to digest if we just look at the two rows here next to the two boxes. So as we work our way from left to right, you see the return for the pension that I cited earlier at -1.2. That was effectively on top of the median. So you'd see here the 50th percentile, where lower numbers are better and higher numbers are worse on a relative peer basis. And kind of the same story, fiscal year, 1 year, kind of hovering around that median. Then we go with the more intermediate long-term period, certainly a little bit more favorable relative to the peer group, kind of oscillating between that top third, top 15%. You know, the latter here, certainly incorporating different market environments, right? Particularly the five-year period, which still incorporates 2022, whereas much of the three-year and the one-year has been really a one-way street higher for equity markets. Now, at the same time, we skip ahead a couple pages, we can look at the same analysis, but on not just a return basis, but also a risk-adjusted basis. So the Sharpe ratio to the right. So in other words, the latter is, you know, how much am I getting paid for the risk that I'm taking? So it's the same sort of peer analysis. And these data to the left, they mimic the data that I showed a couple pages earlier, but we show them again here. So it's a comparison versus, you know, just returns in a vacuum versus risk-adjusted returns. And here you can see some of the underlying dynamics between the asset allocation and some of the underlying investments being a little bit more defensive, how that's been helpful from a risk-adjusted perspective. So again, if we look to the left here, we see the 3, 5, 10-year returns and rankings, and then to the right, the risk-adjusted one. So as I noted on the previous page, the returns in a vacuum kind of oscillate between this top 14%, top third, and we look to the right, kind of hovering around the top decile to top 15%. So a lot of this comes down to, again, the diversified approach that the committee and council has approved over the years, and then the underlying investments being a little bit more defensive. And very important now, not just because the two funds are in a great position from a funded ratio perspective, but also given now that we've moved into a negative cash flow profile. So in other words, Ms. Jennings will let us know probably in a month or so how much the county needs from both respective funds to reimburse the county for benefit payments and other nominal expenses made throughout the year. So with that dynamic, you know, money coming out of both funds now to reimburse the county, we need to make sure that, number one, obviously we have the cash to do that, and I'll talk more about that later on, but number two, more importantly, that we don't raise that cash at a bad time. Right. So in other words, downside protection becomes very important. So we're not selling low to reimburse the county, because once you sell something, you impair it. In other words, you don't allow it to recover. So that's the environment that we're trying to protect against the most. So we see risk adjusted returns being quite important, not quite as important as hitting the actuarial return, but certainly important given the negative cash flow profile that we're in now. As far as the underlying investments, a couple quick comments, and then I'll hit April. But if we look at the pension quickly, these returns are the same ones we saw on the previous page. And then the blue rows are, we see the word composite, it's just synonymous with asset class. So total equity, weighted average of US, global, non-US, you see was down about 2.4%, but about 70 basis points ahead of the policy index benchmark. So the weighted average of the broad US and non-US markets from a policy perspective. Now, some of this outperformance was driven within the US. You could see the weighted average of the three holdings here was down about 3.6% versus the broad market of down 4%, but that admittedly was a little disappointing, and I'll walk through why. Number one, when we think about the construct of how we're putting the pieces together here, to build the U.S. equity allocation. We have a large cap passive index. We're just getting exposure to the S&P 500 at a very cheap cost. And you could see those stocks did underperform the broad market. So by definition, that means that smaller, more mid-sized companies did better. And we have allocations to those areas via the Seton Vance Fund and via the Vanguard Small Cap Value. Now, the latter worked well. You can see it was actually up a little bit more than 3%, providing some of this downside protection. But as far as Eaton Vance is concerned, they have struggled mightily over the past year, to put it mildly. This is a high-quality, more defensive-type strategy that we've used in portfolios for probably more than 15 years now. But more recently, they had a portfolio manager change about 6 to 9 months ago. That was the first, I would call it, little yellow flag. And then in the wake of that change, performance has declined rather notably on a relative basis. Now, some of that's been a proxy of the environment, but also have to consider the fact that some of it may have been driven by the portfolio manager change. So given our concerns, we ended up liquidating this strategy and using a new strategy to replace it at the end of April. And I'll highlight that in a second when we get to the update. As far as the global equity composite, you know, similar story to the U.S., down modestly, some slight outperformance. And really what's driving this this delta or this difference is the fact that two of the three managers, so WCM and MFS, outperform their respective benchmarks, but also having this MFS allocation. I talked a little bit about this last quarter, specifically that their fishing pond is a subset of the global broad equity market. And that subset is comprised of kind of more defensive, more conservative type companies. So their benchmark was, you know, essentially flat or down marginally, about 2.5 percentage points ahead of the broad global equity market. And so again, how the managers did relative to their benchmarks was helpful, but also how we're building this mousetrap. In other words, the composition of the manager benchmarks is a little bit more defensive than the overall broad global equity market. And that was helpful, given the negative returns we saw, particularly in U.S. equities. On the non-U.S. side, you can see actually a positive gain here, up about 2%, largely being driven by DFA, or emerging markets manager here, was up 3% compared to that benchmark that I showed earlier that was marginally flat. And then as we continue through the rest of the asset classes, as I noted earlier, Clarion was up a little bit more than 1%, only comprised about 1.7% of the pension at the end of March. It's even lower today as this continues to wind down. It's admittedly taking a little longer than we had initially thought, but the level it's at now, it's not having a material impact on the pension given its weighting of, again, less than 2%. Infrastructure, as I noted earlier, pretty strong absolute return from JP Morgan, kind of consistently pumping out those 2.5% type of returns and providing a good balance for the overall fund in Q1. Then on the bank load side, you can see our manager here, Aristotle, was marginally negative, but a little bit better than the broad bank load market that was down about 0.5%. And then wrapping up here on fixed income for the pension, you can see marginally positive, a little bit ahead of the benchmark, as Wilmington Trust was up 0.1%. So then by definition, the sort of weighted average return between the remaining two managers also up about 0.1%. So with that said, let me hit the OPEB quickly, and then I'll pause. I'll just jump ahead, and I won't hit many things here because the underlying investments mirror each other. So there's not too much additional things to speak of, except the actual data as it relates to the OPEB, namely the market values and the returns. So as far as Q1, we came into the year, you can see here about $78.34 million, we'll call it. We had a net cash flow that was modestly negative, and then much like the pension, a negative net investment change of about 869 grand. So this translated into a return of negative 1.1%, like modestly better than the pension, but largely due to rounding. There will be differences from time to time due to basically divergences in how, you know, each of the underlying funds are weighted at times at the very margin. But you can see the fiscal year return the exact same. So over time, we would expect those returns to mimic each other, but we can have modest divergences in the short term. And then finally, before I wrap up, just wanted to highlight here, from a rebalancing or activity perspective, thematically the same as the pension, right? So the trimming of international equities in kind of mid late February to the tune of about 675 grand, and the majority of those assets being funneled down into fixed income, but particularly the short end of the yield curve as opposed to the intermediate treasury part. So with all that said, let me pause there. It kind of wraps up what I wanted to say about the report. But before I get to the April update and make some comments around the outlook, let me take a breath here to see if there are any questions or comments around these data.
Does anybody have any questions for Mr. Wang?
Just one and a really basic question. Aristotle Pacific Floating Rate Fund, what's the geography there? Clearly it says Pacific, but.
Here, let me just pull it up so everybody can see what you're referencing. Yep. So Aristotle Pacific Floating Rate Fund, this is just the name of the firm. So they're out on the West Coast.
Oh, so it has nothing to do with the portfolio.
Yeah. Just the name of the firm. So being out on the West Coast, out on the Pacific.
Okay, thank you.
So no, of course, of course. Okay. So let me make, provide an update on April here, and then I'll wrap up some of the comments on the outlook here in just a second. So as I noted at the outset here, maybe about 20 minutes ago, April and first 2 weeks of May, as we sit here this morning, a wildly different environment, almost the polar opposite of what we saw in Q1. So we start at a high level here. We see for the quarter to date, which is this April, pension was up 5.3%. About 80 basis points behind the policy index, largely driven to what happened in equity markets, which I'll speak to in just a minute. From a fiscal year perspective, through the end of April, about 11.4, as we sit here this morning, probably closer to 13%, given what we've seen in May. So about a month and a half to go here in the fiscal year, a decent cushion relative to that return. And I'll circle back to that idea in just a minute. But as far as a relative perspective, we can see the total equity asset class within the pension up just a shade under 9%. But we had global equity markets up north of 10 in 1 month alone, largely driven by anything related to AI, whether it be those selling the picks and shovels, those spending all the money to buy those picks and shovels. The narrative around that has reached, if not at, very close to what we'd argue is a fever pitch, if you will. Now, before I get into the underlying dynamics of what's been driving that, I'll note that within the U.S. equity space, you could see up just under 10% compared to the broad U.S. equity market up 10.2. But here's the replacement that I spoke to earlier about Eaton Vance. So we are using another MFS fund, which is one that we use in the global space. It's a similar investment process, but obviously a different fishing pond, right? So here, these guys are just looking at mid-cap stocks within the U.S. as opposed to the global space, which is looking at more defensive companies in U.S., global, non-U.S. markets. So there's not much overlap because this is predominantly large-cap stocks in the global market, and this is just mid-cap stocks within the U.S. But it's the same team, a similar process, and historically, what we've seen these guys do in the global space is outperform their respective benchmark pretty handily. So we're very hopeful that they'll be able to do that as well in the mid-cap space. And what it should give us is it's a little bit more of a diversified strategy than what we were using with Eaton Vance. So just more certainty around return. So just echoing my comment 5 or 10 minutes ago where I said, you know, the U.S. bucket outperformed in Q1, but admittedly it was a little disappointing because we had the money allocated right across the managers to provide some protection, but one of the managers themselves negated all that by how they perform. So moving forward, when we have the money allocated right across the managers themselves, that should be enough because MFS isn't going to have these wild swings relative to the respective benchmarks as Eaton Vance has over the years. Now in the global equity space, again, kind of the mirror image of what we saw in Q1, instead of two of the three outperforming, it was only one of the three. And then particularly having a more defensive allocation within MFS, a decent headwind as that benchmark was only up 2% compared to the global market up 10. As far as some of the other assets, non-US up about 9%, about a percentage point behind, emerging markets continuing to outperform the broad non-US market, but DFA, unlike Q1, lagging a little bit in the April period where emerging markets were up about 15%. No data on real estate and infrastructure, as I'm sure you all well remember, that's reported on a quarterly basis. And then Aristotle here up 1.3%, so a nice rebound in the 1 month for bank loans. And then fixed income up modestly during the month, up 0.2%. And the same data are consistent with the OPEB too, so I won't bore you with repeating myself there, but from a return perspective, same idea. So taking a step back here, where do we think we are? And I phrase it that way because clearly, you know, we've talked a lot about the market environment over the past couple of years, our concerns around this massive build out and the ultimate return on the investment. And we still have those concerns, but clearly we underestimated the length and, or really the duration and the magnitude of this move in equities. And more recently, as I noted earlier, it's been driven by really anything related to the AI build out. It's been a very narrow market off these lows. I saw an interesting data point earlier this week where we had this massive 10% gain in US equities, but at the same time, within the S&P 500, 30 stocks within that index are making new lows. So it has been incredibly rare. We've had a 10% move in the index itself, and then 6-7% of the entire index actually making new lows. So there are this kind of internal divergences that are giving us a little pause. So as we look out just here on the very, very short term, much like I spoke about in February, our committee meets again on Monday, and I think it would be very likely that we trim some equities again. Like I said, we're going to need the cash to reimburse the county. We probably have most, if not all of it, depending on the number that Ms. Jennings sends me. You can see right here, we're at about 2.75 million in the money market fund. So we probably have that covered, but we'll use this as an opportunity to start to raise a little bit of cash of what we know we're going to need for next year when the markets are ripping higher. The other dynamic that I think we're cognizant of right now is it is a midterm year. Historically, midterm years tend to be a little bit more challenging from a return and volatility perspective. And if history is a guide, we could be in store here as we enter the summer months and then get a little bit closer to that. And it makes more headlines relative to what else is going on in the world today. That could also induce a more challenging environment than what we've seen over the past 5 or 6 weeks. So there's this confluence of factors, namely the narrow rally, the magnitude of this narrow rally and some of the things coming down the pike here that give us some pause, where we're going to be essentially more disciplined from a rebalancing perspective than would have otherwise been the case, right? So in other words, if these dynamics within the market weren't popping up with some yellow flags here and there, and we didn't have a midterm year coming up down the pike here, we would probably be a little bit more comfortable with letting things run. But given those dynamics and just given the fact that historically when you've had these massive moves, coupled with the fact that just, you know, not a ton of stocks driving those moves, if we do get a reversal, it could happen pretty quickly. So we don't necessarily want to tolerate that reversal if and when it does come. So again, with all those dynamics and the confluence of events that we're seeing now and coming down the pike, we're going to be pretty disciplined about rebalancing. Again, just probably taking some chips off the table here in the next week, 10 days here, in anticipation that this summer may prove a little bit more challenging than what we've seen really over the past 5 or 6 weeks. So with all that said, I will pause there. Pretty much wraps up everything I wanted to convey to the committee, but as always, happy to answer any questions or address any comments you have.
Adam, I've got a question. When you do a switch like that from Eaton Vance to MFS, could you just briefly share, like, what is some of Marquette's criteria when they're looking at a new fund like that, whether it's manager tenure or whatever it might be, just some things that you guys are looking at?
Of course. So from a high level, we have a team of, not the exact numbers, probably about 25 to 30 research analysts that cover pretty much every asset class. So within the equity space, we have 5 or 6 people just dedicated to U.S. equities, and they maintain what we call internally, quote unquote, top picks in each area. So MFS was already one of those top pick. So it was an easy transition where we say, all right, we're having issues with Eaton Vance here. It's time to pull the trigger and make a change. We'll go to the research analyst and say, you know, what names do you have as potential replacements? And of those names, what's the best fit for what we already have? Now, to your question around what do we look for? I mean, it's really down to the four P's, right? As they call them, right? The parent, you know, the organization itself is stable and growing. You know, the process underlying the strategy itself, right? Is it clear? Does it make sense? Does it belie the team competitive advantages relative to others out there? The people per your comment, you know, the members of the team, you know, how long have they been there? What's their experience? How well do they work together? And then historical performance. But I would note one other quick thing is in the due diligence process, it's a four-step process. That last step is an on-site, meaning that our analyst team will go to the firm's headquarters to kick the tires, right? Kind of a trust but verify type of engagement. And no strategy gets into the funds without getting through that four-step process, meaning that we do all the due diligence up front, but then we have that on-site. And then the analyst covering that will meet with a wider group, and that committee will determine whether the manager passes through each of the respective stages of the process. And then ultimately, they become a quote-unquote top pick. They're eligible for inclusion.
Awesome. Thank you. That's helpful.
Of course. Of course.
Anybody else have any questions or comments? The only thing I have, Mr. Wing, is listening to you about rebalancing in the next week or two. I will get you an estimate for what we think will draw down. It's not going to be as solid as I would hope it would be, because I'd like to have two pension payouts by then. But we'll get you a number. I'm thinking it's going to be closer to $3
million. Okay.
But I'll get you something by the beginning of next week.
Perfect. That'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Yep. All right.
And the OPEB too, Ms. Jennings?
Yes, we'll get you both numbers. Yep.
Okay. Perfect.
All right. Anybody on the committee have any additional business? No. Okay, hearing none, can I have a motion to adjourn?
Motion.
So moved.
I have a motion and I have a second from Mr. Spindell. Motion from Mr. Rogers. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. All right, we are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care, everyone. Thank you.
Yeah.